chapter 14, verse 23. Let me get that right. It says, "So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth Aven." And we would expect for the text to just bring it to a close right there. Jonathan struck the Philistines. God sends an earthquake. They flee before Israel. Israel pursues them, and it's a great victory. But now the author is going to back up, and he wants to show us that while God was accomplishing this great victory, and it was accomplished, again, by verse 23, that's very clear, it was accomplished, here's Saul almost kind of doing everything within his power to be a hindrance, to what God is doing, and to also be a thorn in the side of the people of Israel. And of course, this affects his son in a major way, as he ends up bringing upon himself a curse because he breaks Saul's vow. So let's go ahead and get into this, and we can learn some things here from Saul. Verse 24, he continues, "Now the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself on my enemies.' So none of the people tasted food." Verse 23, the Lord does this deliverance for Israel. Verse 24, Saul views this as what? An opportunity for revenge for him upon his enemies. God's agenda, verse 23, is to deliver Israel, and he accomplishes that. But Saul views this whole occasion through the lens of his own personal agenda. Okay? This is about him avenging his enemies. He takes his vow, and they were not to eat until I have avenged myself on my enemies. This is never the attitude of the godly, by the way. Not that the godly don't desire justice and seek deliverance from their enemies. Many times in the Psalms and even in 1 and 2 Samuel, we see the psalmist and David crying out to the Lord to deliver them, for God to deliver them from their enemies. In fact, when we look a little later in 1 Samuel chapter 24, we read verse 12. Oh, let me get through this. "May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you." That's David when he's being pursued by Saul. He's just cut the edge of his robe. Saul goes in to relieve himself, and he cuts the edge of his robe, comes out and announces his presence, hands it to him, and this is what he says to him: "The Lord avenge me." Okay? That is the attitude of the godly, is that the Lord is the one avenging for us. We don't seek our own revenge, our own vengeance. This comes out in the song that is written, or I don't know when exactly it was written, presumably towards the end of David's life. It comes at the end of 2 Samuel. "The God who executes vengeance for me and brings down peoples under me, who also brings me out from my enemies. You even lifted me above those who rise up against me. You rescue me from the violent man." Again, that emphasis here, God who executes vengeance for me. That's the attitude of the godly. That's not what Saul is reflecting here. This is all about him. Until I have avenged myself on my enemies. As far as we go today, this attitude is to continue in us. It's something that carries over under the new covenant, for sure. I mentioned this verse this morning. We can name it here again. "Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord." Vengeance is mine. That's God's prerogative. Okay, he's the one who makes sure that justice is served, and we're not to seek our own revenge. So very clear here from Scripture that Saul is out of line with this spirit, with this attitude. He's seeking his own revenge, and this spirit of self is what lays the foundation for the fiasco that we're now about to witness. Okay, when the self agenda of the leader comes out, it only ends up frustrating what God is trying to do. He pursues a personal agenda rather than God's agenda. And because of this, he ends up being a real thorn in the side of the people and hindering what God is doing. I would point out here, this is not merely a misguided agenda, okay? It's not merely a misguided agenda. It's not that, and there are those instances where it's like, well, okay, the person doesn't know any better. No, this is a totally self agenda, and that's what's getting in the way here. Well, it continues on, the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day. Hard-pressed. This is interesting. Back in chapter 13, verse 6, same occasion here. The same word is used with reference to the Philistines when they invaded the men of Israel. They go into hiding. And it says, when the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, there's our word, then the people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and in pits. First, they were hounded by an exterior oppressor, someone outside of the nation. Now they're hindered by and oppressed by someone within the nation, their very own leader. Same word used. God delivers them from the external oppressor, but they asked for the internal oppressor. They asked for Saul. So now they're having to suffer through that choice, and they're starting to find out that, deliverance from their enemies from the outside isn't the only problem to be dealt with. They went and chose this other leader, and now they have, a problem on the inside, and they have someone who's making life difficult for them at the top of the leadership chain here. Well, verse 25, he continues on, all the people of the land entered the forest, and there was honey on the ground. When the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put out his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath. Therefore, he put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Here they are. We now have a test, okay? There's honey on the ground. Everybody's walking past the honey. And lo and behold, Jonathan comes by and he does what's very natural. He's wondering why no one has taken the honey. Why is it so much available to me? He looks at this and probably thinks it's the hand of the Lord to sustain him. He takes his staff, dips it into the honey, and puts it to his mouth. But everyone else is refraining here. But no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. As the Lord's anointed, Saul did have the authority to put a binding oath over the nation. Frequently we see that. You could go back to the instance with Joshua and the elders. Joshua and the elders make an oath to the Gibeonites, and they have to keep it. All the people grumbled. What'd you guys do that for? There was, as their leader, as their authority in the nation, their oaths, whatever oath they placed the people under, was binding. And so they are now put under a curse if they were to partake. This is what we might call a man-made sin. This is a man-made sin. Would it have been sin for them to do as Jonathan did? No, not under normal circumstances. Only when the leader foolishly makes an oath that brings a curse upon the person who does it. And so the breaking of the vow, the breaking of the word, now becomes the sin, ultimately. It says there, but Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath. Jonathan, if you remember, had ventured out on his own. He initiated the battle with the Philistines without his father's knowledge. His father, once everything's unfolding, he numbers the people, finds out Jonathan isn't there. What's really ironic is even when he now knows that Jonathan isn't there, that's when he takes this oath. He places the people under this oath. So he knew he was gone, and yet he foolishly did this. Well, Jonathan puts his hand to his mouth, his eyes brighten. You can't conquer tyranny on an empty stomach. And so here he is, making the move, a very wise move of feeding himself to continue the battle, but it ends up being a big mistake. Verse 28, then one of the people said, your father strictly put the people under oath, saying, cursed be the man who eats food today. The people were weary. Then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found? for now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. One wonders why nobody notified him before he partook of the honey. It would seem that they were there to witness this event. There were those around, and it wasn't until he partook that they said, "Hey, what are you doing? Why didn't anyone think of that before?" That's a good question. Jonathan doesn't mince any words here. "My father has troubled the land." That is the truest statement made in this whole section that we're looking at here. He nails it. The man of faith nails it. At this point, Saul is seen to be nothing but trouble for Israel. Everything that comes after this, it just flows out of this fact that he made this hasty, foolish vow, and he is nothing but trouble for Israel after this. Everything that he does to try and rectify the situation, he created the situation. And his attitude, his sanctimonious attitude that he exhibits later, is really quite hollow. Because, indeed, he was the root of the problem here. Jonathan nails it with these words. Rather than freely following God's lead, they are now stifled by a foolish leader. Remember, Jonathan stepped out in faith, and then God responds with this earthquake. And rather than just being able to follow God's lead and what God was doing and pursuing God's power that was going before them, now they're stifled because of this foolish vow. And Jonathan points that out. It says, now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. Later we read of how the Philistines are a persistent problem during the reign of Saul. I think we're getting a glimpse into why. They were never really fully taken care of because I think Saul ultimately was his own worst enemy. Well, verse 31, he continues, they struck among the Philistines that day from Michmash to Aijalon, and the people were very weary. The people rushed greedily upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today. Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, each one of you bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat. And do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So all the people that night brought each one his ox with him and slaughtered it there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. In verse 28, we read that they were weary. Now we read that that was the time when Jonathan had partaken of the honey. By nightfall, we read that they were very weary. Okay, there's a progression here in the language that is used. They were weary, now they're very weary, so weary that they rush upon the spoil at nightfall and they make a mistake. They end up sinning against the Lord. They're so ferociously hungry that they forgo the process of draining the blood. This is perhaps something we don't always think about when we bite into a steak or whatnot, but in that time, under the law, they were required to drain the blood before they ate any kind of meat. This goes back to the law. For as for the life of all flesh, its blood is identified with its life. Therefore, I said to the sons of Israel, you are not to eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all flesh is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. And of course, that word cut off is death. Okay, I mean, that's really what that denotes there. God says that its life is identified with the blood. For that reason, they're not to partake of the blood. They were to drain it out completely. However, you may slaughter and eat meat within any of your gates, whatever you desire. Only you shall not eat the blood. You are to pour it out on the ground like water. So that's what they were to do with it. They were not to eat it. They were to pour it out and cover it up. Again, were they eating the meat raw? It's kind of interesting. They're in such a rush that they're not eating it you know, with the blood drained. Were they eating it raw too? There's nothing strictly forbidding that in the Old Testament, just with the blood. I'm getting a few looks there like, ugh. just the picture looks pretty gruesome at this point, doesn't it? But here they are. They rush up. They're obviously very hungry. They're not going through this process of draining the blood. And so Saul catches wind of this. Then they told Saul, saying, "Behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." Isn't it ironic that the one who consistently uses the people as an excuse for sin is now blind to his role in this sin? He says, and he said, "You have acted treacherously." I mean, he now launches into accusation mode here for the people. He seems to have no perception as to his own role in this. You ever known anybody like that? where you're just like, yeah, you don't see it, do you? That's where Saul's at. Saul's one of these individuals that here he is pursuing this self agenda as manifested in his phrase earlier, until I avenge myself. Very much self is on the brain here. He's not thinking about anybody else. He's not thinking about God. He's not thinking about his soldiers. And so now they go and do this. It's told to Saul, and I can't help but hear just a touch of sanctimonious, here with Saul. He says, "You have acted treacherously." And if you were Saul's soldiers at this point, what would you be feeling at that moment? "You've acted treacherously." It's like, us? You know, we acted treacherously? Have you not noticed what, you know, have you not noticed what the implications of what you did to us is? Aren't you just the pot calling the kettle black here? So Saul now says, "Roll a great stone to me today." This is for the purpose of slaughtering the livestock before them, okay, by placing it on a rock. That would have enabled the blood, you know, gravity to work on the animal, okay, to drain the blood out. That's the purpose of the stone. He sets this stone up before him. He's going to now supervise the slaughter of these animals. Verse 34, "Each one of you bring me his ox or his sheep and slaughter it here and eat it." Saul is now the pious one, holding everybody accountable, right? Making sure they keep the law. He created the problem, and now he thinks that by personally micromanaging it, he's going to make it better. Foolishness here. He's micromanaging the situation to solve the problem, but again, it's the problem that he created. So all the people that night brought each one his own ox with him and slaughtered it there. In my opinion, he, in many ways, compounded the burden here. Imagine being the last one in line. I mean, here you are with your animal, and you're already having to wait, and now you have to wait in this line. Who knows how long this would have taken, however many thousands of men were dealing with this, going through and slaughtering these animals. They're waiting here, and, you know, I'm sure the hours are passing by. You've already been through a day of battle. You're weary from the battle. You need sleep. And here you are now having to wait to eat as the blood is draining from all these creatures. It continues on, "And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord." Isn't it significant how he wants to point that out to us? This was the first altar. What does this indicate? It was common for leaders, and we see this frequently throughout the history of Israel. When a leader or an individual wants to honor God, what does he do? He builds an altar to the Lord. Okay, it's an act of worship. It's a mark of honor to the Lord. We see here that Saul was not in the habit of honoring the Lord in this way. Okay, he's been king for some time now. Now he's what I would say is he's getting a pious bone here, and he's starting to by building this altar here. Well, verse 36, he continues on. "Then Saul said, 'Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them.' And they said, 'Do whatever seems good to you.' So the priest said, 'Let us draw near to God here.' Saul inquired of God, 'Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?' But he did not answer him on that day." Saul proposes continuing the pursuit the same night. Okay, And the people reply, do whatever seems good to you. That's an interesting statement. When I read that, do whatever seems good to you, they're compliant, they're willing to go along, but I don't hear a lot of enthusiasm. Do what seems good to you. They don't say, hey, we're with you, go for it. If that's in your heart, no, do what seems good to you. I think there's a lack of enthusiasm here, especially as we look at the full context. The whole chapter testifies to an army that really, I think, is beleaguered by their leader at this point. They're weary, they're frustrated by what's going on. At least that would be the natural human response to everything that we've been studying. Saul is a wearisome leader, and now he wants to take them further. I'm sure most of them want this night just to end. Could we all just go home now? The priest said, let us draw near to God here. One wonders if he didn't make this this suggestion, hoping that the Lord would kind of put the kibosh on this, that he would. And of course he does. But he does say, let us seek the Lord here. You might remember that earlier in the battle, when it first started unfolding and the earthquake's going on and there's all kinds of confusion, that Saul initially seeks the Lord. He wants the priest to seek the Lord on his behalf, and yet things are happening so fast he cuts him off, and they never get to that. Now the priest is bringing up the matter, and they do inquire. Saul does think this is a good idea, but it says he did not answer him on that day. And the question now becomes why? There's several things going on in this chapter at this point. One cannot help but think of the foolishness that Saul has, his foolishness has tainted basically the entire day through this vow. Then, of course, there is Jonathan's failure to keep the oath. Even though he was ignorant, he failed to keep the oath. Then there is the people, the people eating meat with the blood in it. What follows seems to point to Jonathan, okay? But upon closer examination, I think it only serves to reveal more that the real issue is Saul. Okay, yes, Jonathan did sin, and that is pointed out as they cast lots. But ultimately, I think as Saul even responds further to the whole situation, it reveals his foolishness, that he really is the problem here. Well, verse 38, he continues, Saul said, draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But not one of all the people answered him. Saul has enough sense to know that there's a sin afoot here. The reason that God is not responding, well, you know, something happened. Somebody sinned, and so he seeks to find out. Sin's to blame, and he wants to see what it is. What's the problem? Before the Lord reveals the culprit, though, he hastily makes another vow. Here he is. He hasn't learned anything. He hastily makes another vow. Before he even knows the case, he says, for as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. Notice that he doesn't say, though it is in myself, I will surely die. Again, this guy is just, you know, wounding everyone. He's like an archer who wounds everyone, Proverbs talks about. And he's somewhat unscathed, it would seem. The lot will fall to Jonathan, but his sin was in no way worthy of death. Let me explain why. I think I've touched on this in the past in this study, but in Numbers 15:28 we have this statement. The priest shall make atonement for the Lord before for the person who goes astray when he sins unintentionally, making atonement for him that he may be forgiven. There was atonement for unintentional sins. Very clearly in the chapter, Jonathan's sin was not intentional. He was totally ignorant of the vow that his father had placed him under. Verse 13, but the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people. So here's Saul. He's the judge in the of the land, the highest authority in the court, and before he even hears the case, he's already pronounced the judgment. And because of the oath, he should die. Just like because of the oath, he should have died earlier as far as the curse. So here we have, just again, this guy multiplying his own problems for other people here. It does say here, after he makes this vow, but not one of all the people answered him. Now remember, the lot could have fallen to them too. They'd just gotten done devouring all this meat with the blood in it. They don't know what the outcome of this is either, and so they're all quiet. It's like, well, he may have just pronounced a death sentence on us. Well, verse 40 continues, then he said to all Israel, you shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan, my son, will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. Therefore, Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot. And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. So, Saul said, cast lots between me and Jonathan, my son. And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. So Jonathan told him and said, I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of my the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I must die. Saul said, may God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot. And indeed he does. This is from the hand of the Lord. I think he is pointing to Jonathan, but I don't think God's real issue is with Jonathan. He's magnifying Saul's foolishness here. A foolishness that ultimately everybody around him can see, and the people are the ones who reverse this foolish vow. Everything we see from Jonathan leads us to believe that when he says, here I am, I must die, I think he was sincere when he said that. He is the man of faith here. I think he did want to honor the Lord. He realizes the gravity of these vows that his father keeps throwing out there at everyone. And I think he was sincere when he says, I must die. The one who, again, is nauseatingly sanctimonious is Saul. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. Boy, let's not forget that the day began with Saul losing the kingdom. Because he had sinned against the Lord, okay, because he himself was impatient. There seems to be a lot of sin on this day, and Saul should have been expecting that even he could have been chosen in this lot. But now it's, tell me what you have done. Well, I broke your stupid vow. That's what I would have been tempted to say. I broke your stupid vow. That would have been my response, maybe me in my flesh. Thanks for needlessly now giving me a death sentence with a second vow, okay? This is not the kind of judge you want to adjudicate your case. I mean, could you imagine showing up before a judge and he says, well, whoever's guilty, they're going to die. And, you know, when the law clearly says, well, no, they don't have to die if it's unintentional. Well, now they do. You just took a vow. Saul said, may God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. You know, if he was really going to be sincere with that, he spares Jonathan. He should have done it to himself, right? Here he is. This guy is very flippant with his words. And as we go on, it was interesting. Jan and I were reading, I think it is chapter 24. It's amazing to pick up how many times Saul makes vows and really he never ever keeps them. Okay, he's not a man of his word. He uses that phrase, as the Lord lives, a lot. And it's very flippant and it's very insincere. He never really ultimately keeps his word. He has no remorse. No regret, no sense of his own foolishness. He just presses on. He presses on in his foolishness here. I thought of this proverb as we look at this passage. He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and shame to him. He should be ashamed right now, but he's not. Okay? He's not ashamed. And it's interesting when we see a similar instance. Can someone think of a similar instance where someone gave a foolish vow that cost someone else their life? Jephthah. Yeah, Jephthah. Jephthah vowed that, you know, whatever the... Who would ever say this? The first, Lord, if you give me victory, the first thing that comes out of my house, I'll sacrifice to the Lord. And yet, you know, it's interesting. When she does come out, he took his vow very seriously because he says, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. And you are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back. I mean, I hear a grieving father there. I messed up royally. Saul seems to have no sense of that. He has no sense that he has been a fool the entire day. His foolish vow is what got his son into trouble in the first place, and now he's just pronounced taking a vow that requires him to die. Well, the people have finally had enough, and they make a vow of their own. Verse 45. But the people said to Saul, "Must Jonathan die who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. I don't know what to make of that. I mean, you got the people making a vow now. You got Saul's vow, you got their vow, you got conflicting vows now. What's to happen there? I don't know. This tension isn't really resolved, but Jonathan is delivered. Again, everyone is able to see what's going on, everyone that is, except for Saul. Everyone can see how foolish this is. It's like, you know, we don't really attribute this victory to you. We really see where Jonathan was the key individual here today, and this is frustrating. Why is the fool, you know, we're kind of actually looking forward to Jonathan becoming king someday now, instead of you. Finally, the voice of reason, he has worked with God this day. They can see it. Again, I mentioned earlier, here's the man of faith freely pursuing, you know, the path that God is plowing for Israel right here, being stifled by the foolish leader. Well, verse 46, he continues on. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Now, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. He acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger Michal. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz, and the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. When Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. It is very unusual for an author in these historical books, 1 and 2 Samuel, you get into 1 and 2 Kings, Chronicles, it is very unusual for the author to summarize the king's career so early. And it's kind of interesting. Different commentators have seen that maybe this summation comes so early in the reign, because in God's eyes, his reign was over when it began. We know that the kingdom has now been taken away from him. He will not have an enduring dynasty, and that may be the intent here, to indicate that, again, his reign was over before it began. It says, now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. Given the example of his leadership in this chapter, we see that part of that was due to his own foolishness, I would say. He did not prove to be the best leader of the people. Well, in closing here today, as I think about this, many years ago, and I can't remember if it was a Sunday school class or if it was, I think it was, because Vince spoke up. And this always stuck with me. Vince was replying to the teacher's question, and he says, we as leaders need to be careful not to make stupid rules. And I always thought of this chapter as the stupid rules chapter. This is one of those instances where you see where poor leadership, and in this case, a self-absorbed leader, a person who gets a self-agenda, it sets him on a path where he's making life difficult for everybody. He's frustrating what God's trying to do, and he ends up making stupid rules, okay? Have you ever suffered under a boss or any authority who is accustomed to making stupid rules? Yeah, and then you get into trouble because of the stupid rules, and then they micromanage you because you're not competent enough to keep their stupid rules. You know, that happens. And these individuals, they create their own problems, and yet they somehow think it's you, and you're just like, yes. Don't be one of them. I mean, I think about this. You know, there's certain things that we can learn from bad leaders, and that you find out, I think of husbands specifically, you find out what's frustrating about your boss. Don't be that kind of husband. Don't frustrate your wife by being that kind of leader. I mean, in some ways, there's application in all spheres here. And it's certainly true in the spiritual realm as well. Look at Matthew 23:4. They, the Pharisees, tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. It's easy to tie up loads for other people to carry, isn't it? You know, that's a real easy thing to do. You say, well, Saul made this vow. He put himself under it as well. Yeah, but did Saul really do the heavy lifting that day? Was he really engaged in the battle? I mean, he certainly didn't start that way. He's kind of playing catch up here. He's hanging out under the pomegranate tree. I'm not getting a picture of a guy who's out there actually engaged in the battle. So here are the men actually doing the fighting, and they're the ones who needed to be doing the eating, and they're not able to because of his vow. Very heavy burden that he placed upon the people. Good leadership. Good leadership, leadership that is born out of faith in God, is sensitive to what the Lord is doing. Here's Saul, totally blind to what the Lord is doing, pursuing his own agenda. A good leader, a godly leader, is going to seek God's agenda, not a self agenda. And also I see, too, something that Saul is lacking here I think a good leader places the highest demand on himself, not others. He's not accustomed to tying up heavy loads for other people to carry. Okay? You've heard this before, I'm sure, and it fits here. Don't ask anyone to do something you yourself are not willing to do. You've heard that before, I'm sure. Don't ask anyone to do something that you yourself are not willing to do. It's good to think about that as when you become critical as well, too. You know, a critical spirit could be put on, you know, it's like, okay, well, am I really living up to the standard I'm holding other people to? Jesus said, by the standard you measure others, you'll be measured yourself by him. Again, Saul placed himself under the oath, but was he really doing the heavy lifting that day? Someone can function like a Saul, even if he doesn't hold a position. Anyone can be sanctimonious and very frustrating to those around them and have expectations for them that they really don't hold themselves to. And, pride is blinding. They don't really see this. We always need to be merciful and cautious and humble, I think, in our dealings with other people. It's good to just kind of realize when you see someone like Saul and you see, boy, he just doesn't get it. Everyone around him gets it. Everyone around him can see that, you know, that he is just making a disaster of this whole occasion. We need to be able to take a step back and say, okay, I need to be humble. Am I being too much for everybody around me? Am I making people's lives difficult? Am I frustrating those around me and to the point of weariness, as the case was for Saul's men? Let's be humble and be cautious and merciful in that regard.